From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On paper, Mitt Romney is the perfect presidential candidate if you're a Republican. Handsome and successful, with a handsome and successful family, a squeaky clean personal life. But Romney's having a hard time breaking through in national politics. He seems to be the choice for most establishment Republicans, but Newt Gingrich is just the latest candidate to surge past him in the polls. Today in the program, we're asking why. Why Romney can't seem to connect with some voters. Our guest is the journalist Ronald Scott, who's written a book that takes an inside look at Romney's public and private life. He'll join us today to talk about Romney's family history, the origins of his character and convictions, and the influence of his faith. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to get an inside look at the Republican presidential candidate, Mitt Romney. On paper, Romney is the ideal candidate, but of course, he's having a hard time breaking through in national politics. Our guest today is the journalist Ronald B. Scott, who's just published a book on Romney, which takes a decidedly personal approach. We're going to talk today about Romney's family history, about the origins of his convictions and his political ambitions, and also the reason he hasn't been resonating with some Republican voters. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Ronald B. Scott is a journalist who wrote for Time Magazine and other Time Incorporated publications. His work has also appeared in USA Today, in the Boston Globe, the Salt Lake Tribune. His book is called Mitt Romney, An Inside Look at the Man and His Politics. And Ronald Scott is joining us today from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. And Ronald Scott, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin with why it is that you wanted to write the book. And I have to say it's interesting because it seems like part of the decision was based on your own kind of personal familiarity with Mr. Romney, not just as a distant observer. Is that right?
That's correct. I've known him personally since about 1986, 87. And so as his political career evolved, my interest in his political career evolved with it. But my interest in the Romney family dates back to when his father ran for president in 1968, and even before that, when he was governor of Michigan.
You say that this has been one of the toughest reporting assignments of your life. Why?
Well, in part. Because you're reporting about somebody you know personally, and you're reporting about a religion that you're familiar with intimately. And most importantly, at the beginning of the process, I was told I would have some inside access to the family, and it turned out in the end that it was not. And I guess the fourth part is somewhat shaped by that. The deadlines for delivering the manuscript were very tight, so we began work on the novel on the Freudian slip there. We began work on the book in early June, thinking we would have the family's cooperation. The deadline for delivering the manuscript was the first part of August, which is a daunting challenge to anybody, and it certainly was to me. So it was very, very tough, and we were reporting as we went. And so that constitutes why it was a tough assignment.
Well, what happened? Why didn't the Romney camp cooperate in the end, do you think?
It's a good question. People have read the book since then, including some of the people on the campaign staff, have reacted in a way of what was the problem. And we can't see the negatives that apparently some people inside the campaign saw at the very beginning. From the very beginning, they asked the question, well, is it going to be a positive or a negative book? And
sure.
And my response, obviously, was it's going to be neither. It's going to be a balanced report on the family. Is going to be an attempt to humanize him. The initial working title, as you may know, was The Heart of the Tin Man. So we were looking to provide evidence that this guy is real, that he is more than a good-looking guy in a suit, that there's substance and texture and heart there, and that was the object of the book. And I think we delivered on that in part, But it also came with kind of a warts and all approach to things, yeah. And I think the warts part made them nervous. unfortunately, because I think actually the warts would have made him a much more credible candidate long-term and may account for the fact that he's having some difficulty with Republican voters in the sense that they don't really know who is this guy, what makes him tick, what does he do when he gets up in the morning, does he cry, does he sweat, you know, those kinds of textured things that we look for in presidential candidates.
But Ronald Scott, is this a characteristic of Mitt Romney, this idea of trying to not reveal everything, that it's maybe too personal, and not just that, but the difficult parts of it? Is that an element to, which will break down as we go, as your book does, an element to his character, which was shaped by, of course, his upbringing, but also his faith?
I'm not sure I understand all the parts of your question. But
well,
let me
restate it then. Okay. It's probably confusing.
I'm easy to confuse.
They were uncomfortable with you revealing the warts and all. Is that a characteristic of Mitt Romney that was informed by his faith, not revealing the uglier parts or the more difficult parts of a person's life?
I think I understand the question now.
Okay.
You won't mind if I duck that question, will you?
No.
Just kidding. Yeah, okay. The answer to the question is, yeah, I hadn't looked at it that way, but you make a good point. The church does like to reveal the positive side of the church and not the negative side, and that could have shaped Romney's approach to things. I think not, but it's a legitimate argument. Interesting argument.
Yeah.
But the answer to the question from Mitt's standpoint is, yeah, he likes to control everything, and so controlling his brand is preeminent in his mind, and it probably bothers him a lot that when you run for political office, whether it's the U.S. Senate or whether it's the governorship of Massachusetts or president of the United States, that you throw yourself out there to be judged by not just the voters, but by the people who communicate your message to the voters, people like me and the thousands of other reporters who are covering the campaign. And if you're a guy like Mitt, that's got to be galling. And you put that in the context of here in 1968, the thing that drove his father from being the president of the United States, arguably, was a quote that was blown out of proportion and leveraged over and over again by his opponents in the Republican Party and fed to the general populace by the news media, one of whom happened to be my first boss at Time Magazine, and we used to go around on this issue of how could you guys be so gullible to think that he really meant he was serious when he said he was brainwashed, as opposed to being a metaphor for what we all experienced with regard to Vietnam. So there was this built-in paranoia. I think there's this built-in paranoia with Mitt about the news media and hence his reluctance to cooperate with even people that he knows. And I may have made him more uncomfortable because I may be one of those who, in his mind, may have known too much.
Yeah. Well, let's get this out of the way. I mean, you yourself are Mormon. And I suppose you expected that that's going to make some people naturally suspicious of your intentions.
You know, it's a funny thing. It does. It makes people who are not Mormons who don't know me wonder whether I'm some kind of a shill for the Romney camp and
sure.
for the Mormon Church and so
right.
forth.
Right.
And conversely, it makes a lot of Mormons uncomfortable and concerned that I may be anti-Mormon.
Yeah.
So it's kind of you can't win for losing that kind of a proposition. That with some you're a suspect because of these sets of this set of circumstances, and with the other you're a suspect because you're a suspect non-Mormon. I work for the Salt Lake Tribune as part of my career in Salt Lake City, and I also work for the Deseret News. But so there's that suspicion: is he with us or is he Guinness? Coming from some Mormons in Utah, and some think that I'm an anti-Mormon. So.
I wonder, being LDS, has that been a hindrance or has it helped put Mitt Romney's life in perspective for those who don't understand?
Well, I've been putting Mormonism in perspective as a journalist all my career, and I think my ability to communicate in ways that resonate with non-members has been pretty good over the course of my career. So having that inside view and that feel for Mormonism that you only can get if you're raised in it and if you're connected to it in more than superficial ways, that's been a help in terms of explaining it and making it understandable to the outside world. Was there a downside to that? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But I've been around long enough to know that you can't write about the church without creating negatives and positives, no matter what you write. It's just impossible to please everybody all the time.
Yeah, you tell this story. This was from 1988, when Mitt Romney was a stake president, which is a leader for those uninitiated of a fairly large Mormon diocese, essentially, and this was in Boston.
Right.
Now, you talk right about the fact that you weren't a conventional member, not particularly devout, you said, but you had requested this meeting with Mitt Romney to resolve this dispute between these two bishops, and you came away with this impression, but it was a wrong impression. It's an interesting story. I wonder if you'd share that.
Yeah, actually, it was a series of encounters with Mitt, and it came to head when my oldest, our oldest child was being born, and there was an issue in our ward, and we were marginally active at the time, one of the wives of the bishop of our current bishop who was involved was in my wife's hospital room and talking about this circumstance, and we had known about it for some time, and after that encounter in the hospital room, I said we need to do something because we have two bishops who are at odds with each other, one who is clearly in the wrong and one who is clearly in the right, and the only person that can solve this is the stake president. He knows both men. He knows both men very personally. He likes them both. And he's from a church standpoint, he's the right guy to resolve this problem before it becomes a divisive thing in our congregation. And even though I was marginally active at the time, you don't like to see good people fighting with each other over things that could be resolved and ought to be resolved quickly. Yeah. And that's what precipitated the meeting. He was aware of the situation when I met with him in his office in the church behind him, where the temple now sits in Boston. He was concerned about the problem, thanked me for my time and for my interest, and we had a good long conversation, a very productive conversation. And then he began to take some action to correct it. And his way of correcting it, well, I thought it was the proper way to go ultimately, and that was to these two guys ought to settle things in the civil courts as opposed to in church courts. I was initially taken aback that he just didn't say, let me write the check that will make this problem go away, and then you two guys figure out how I'm going to be reimbursed, but in the meantime, we'll have peace. He didn't do that, and I was astonished at that because that's sort of what I've always expected Mormon people to do for each other, and particularly somebody who was so well endowed financially as Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. Didn't realize until years later that he actually had offered to do exactly what I expected him to do, and that had been turned down by the person who was out of pocket for a fairly substantial sum of money, $300,000. So it wasn't a small petty issue; it was a fairly major issue.
You tell this story early in the book about this conversation you had. This was in 2008 with this Boston business and community leader, and by the name of Jack Connors. Mm-hmm. That seemed to give you some insight, Ronald Scott, into why people who are impressed with Mr. Romney and his accomplishments and his abilities often seem to attach that caveat to their impression. Tell that story because it seems like that's where you got at least the initial title to the book.
It is, what Jack Connors was a president of a very large advertising agency in Boston that's since been purchased by Omnicom. I think it's Omnicom. Anyway, and he's probably the preeminent mover and shaker, deal maker in Boston, and known to everybody, including Mitt, quite well. Mm. He was the person that put together the Harvard Mass General Hospital Alliance, this now called Partners. So a really very, very important man in Boston and a reasonably good friend of mine. And we were talking about the book and Mitt's forthcoming campaign. This is in 2007, and he had worked with Mitt on a couple of business issues, I think, on the health care program for Massachusetts and getting some of the small businesses aligned behind the universal health care program in Massachusetts. And he said, well, he's a really great guy, fantastic guy, very, very competent, good-looking, and well-spoken and all that. And then his hand began to flutter over his chest, and he said, "But he has no heart like the Tin Man." And of course, what Jack didn't realize, or maybe he did realize, that in the Dorothy, the Wizard of Oz story, the Tin Man thinks he doesn't have a heart, but when he goes looking for it, he discovers it was always there. And so the metaphor really worked neatly for what we were trying to accomplish. That, you know, here's this guy who's fairly stiff and doesn't work a room really well. Like Connors is fantastic at working a room, so he has that in contrast to Jack. But who underneath that's fairly stiff exterior is a decent human being who has been giving to people and helping people all of his life, but it's under-recognized because of his stiffness and his formality and so forth.
You say that his own father spotted that problem back in 1994 when he was running against Teddy Kennedy, told Mitt Romney, he said, you need to ignore some of this advice you're getting and be yourself.
Well, his dad was the absolute opposite of that. I mean, I remember a famous picture of him from Time magazine when I was a young missionary in New England in 1965 or 66. Here he is walking down a main thoroughfare in Detroit, in a sea of black faces, and there's one white guy in the sea of black faces. His white shirt undone, his tie askew, sweat pouring down his face, his sleeves rolled up, and that's George Romney, out there mixing it up with the people. So, and he was the kind of guy who could mix really well with the common folk. His son, the next generation, was more awkward in similar kinds of situations, and his dad saw it in '94 and said, "Hey, listen, you've got to." Stop listening to your handlers, and who dress you and tell you how to behave and what to say and how to turn a phrase and so forth, and just be yourself. Relax. Just be who you are because you're a good person. You've been raised well. I'm putting words in his mouth now, but that was the message I think that George was communicating to Mitt at the time.
Did he end up taking the advice?
No, I think he tried to.
Yeah.
But I think at the time the advice was given, it was in the '94 campaign. It was pretty much a done deal that Kennedy was going to win re-election, and what chances Mitt had for an upset were on the way out the door. So he didn't really have a chance to do that. But I think he understood what his dad was saying, and he talked to a brother after it and other people afterward, and he said, "I'm never going to run for an office that I can't win again." And he had taken on Kennedy, and it was an against-all-odds kind of competition, and had done really well, but had lacked the instinct, the killer instinct, to go for the jugular when he could have to actually win the election. He had a good chance to win the election, as it turned out, but got hammered at the end, and was not prepared to get hammered the way he did at the end.
Yeah, you. There's this element of the sort of the Romney family you write about. You quote this anonymous relative of Romney's who told you that there was this kind of noblesse oblige to the Romney clan, that this person told you that Mitt would have made an ideal benevolent king, born, you write, sincerely believing that he knows better. And this idea of knowing better seems to be one of the sort of elements of the Romney family, do you think?
I don't know George well enough to know whether that was the case, but it has been said of him that he is the person that loaded the responsibility of running for president on Mitt's shoulders when he was very, very young, and had it not been for that obligation that George loaded on Mitt's shoulders, that Mitt may have been perfectly happy to be a very successful businessman, a church leader, and maybe even a general authority of the Mormon Church. But there was this responsibility loaded on his shoulders by George that I think the relative referred to George as the Svengali of the Romney family. Mm-hmm. that was a burden that Mitt carried around all of his life. So there probably is an element of we were put on this earth, and it may be a Mormon kind of thing in that respect.
Well, you write this. You write, the Romneys were people who, quote, expected, even demanded the world become as they imagined it because they willed it that way.
Yeah, I think if you look at things in Mitt's life, and I'm not a psychiatrist and I'm not a psychologist, but and you look at George's life, the way he pursued Lenore, leaving Utah short of graduating from college, chasing her across the country to Washington, I think following her to Los Angeles where she wanted to be a movie star, and then finally persuading her to marry him. And then he becomes a PR guy for speechwriter in Washington for a Utah congressman, and works his way up into the steel industry, and then on to American Motors, where he becomes chairman of the board of American Motors. And what an unlikely story that is, even in that generation. But it shows a kind of guy who knows what he wants, and he sets out to get it, and he gets it because he wills it, and he makes it happen. And that's what I meant when I wrote those lines. Mitt did the same thing when he goes off on his mission to France. His current wife, who had just recently joined the Mormon Church, was graduated from high school, went to BYU. I take note of the fact that you don't want to have, if you're hoping a girl will wait for you while you serve a mission, the last place you want her going to school is BYU. and sure enough, she's dating somebody else. He comes back from his mission, and he's anxious to get back because he knows what's going on and what that means. He gets back, and they get in the family station wagon. They're back in the way back of the station wagon on the way home.
On the way home from the airport, let's say.
From the way home from the airport.
He's just getting back.
Right. And I know what that's like, and I know that it's a very emotional time, and you're anxious to get on with your life and so forth. And he says, well, you know, he reiterates the message that he communicated when they were 17 and 15, I think, will you marry me? I mean, it's interesting enough that he proposed to her when they were teenagers, and then on the way home from the airport, he does it again. So this is a guy who knows what he wants. And then the final part of that is they wanted to do it immediately.
Yeah.
They wanted to get married. I think the next week would have been too long of a wait for them, and their parents persuaded them to wait till he got reestablished and they were closer to the end of the semester at BYU before they did it. But it was within months of getting home that they got married.
Well, we should mention
that is a quintessential Mormon story, by the way.
It's not a
out of character kind of thing. Even though he's raised in Detroit with very wealthy circumstances, that is so familiar of a story. He could have been raised where I was in East Mill Creek.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This does raise the question: is Mitt Romney? Because throughout the book, there are all these different kinds of stories. Where on one hand, he seems like he could have been raised in Salt Lake City, which is, of course, the headquarters for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. On the other hand, he does have a kind of outsider take on some of these things. I mean, is he a conventional Mormon? That's sort of the question, I suppose.
Well, I'm not sure what a conventional Mormon is these days, quite frankly.
Right.
Somebody referred to Governor Huntsman as being an inactive Mormon, and I said, gee, I think probably he would wince at that kind of a description. and I wince when somebody refers to me as whatever kind of a Mormon they refer to me as.
Yeah.
And because I think in one way or another, most Mormons are unconventional in their own ways. Some are just different than others, and some seem more traditional because your own perspective on Mormonism is so traditional. So, is he unconventional? The answer is I don't think so. Does he have a different take on church governance because he was raised outside of Utah? That's possible.
Hmm.
The difference probably comes down to the responsibility that a church leader feels in Massachusetts and Germany and elsewhere for being the leader of the church in a particular area. And for a good long time, Mitt was the senior church leader in Boston for 8-9 years, and certainly the most prominent Mormon in Boston for all that time. And so I recall Howard W. Hunter, who became president of the Mormon Church, coming through Boston at the time that was stake president, and giving the instruction that, gee, things are going so well for the church worldwide, that brings with a lot of responsibilities, and we have to focus a lot of attention on the other parts of the world, Africa in particular. And said he to a fairly large group of people, we expect the leaders of the church in places like Boston to take responsibility for what's happening in their area. We're not looking for them to check in with us. We want them to take responsibility for it, just to do it, remove that burden from us. And that is the kind of instruction that a church leader in Salt Lake City probably is not given, but a church leader in Boston would be given. So Mitt felt a certain amount of independence, I think, for how to do things in Boston that a stake president in Salt Lake City or Provo or Logan or Southern Idaho would not feel in particular.
The question inevitably comes up then, of course, how much influence would Romney's church leaders have over him? And there's a lot about that in the book. I want to get to some of this. We've got to head to a break, but I want to ask you, you write about his father, George Romney, unwilling to submit to pressure from some of the apostles of his church. These are leaders in the upper echelons of Mormon hierarchy. There's a similar kind of story you relate about this time in 2008 when the LDS church was pushing the support of Proposition 8 in California, which of course would eliminate the marriage rights of same-sex couples. Mitt Romney was asked by a Mormon apostle apparently to get involved, and he demurred.
Those facts aren't exactly right.
Okay.
He didn't get involved in the Proposition 8 campaign in California in 2009, even though church members from all over the country did. I'm sure that was deliberate. Otherwise he would have been involved in it. The incident with the apostle happened years earlier when the church was pushing for definition of marriage amendments and defense of marriage amendments in all the states, and they came to Massachusetts. One of the apostles came to Massachusetts, met with the stake presidency, and said, "Here's what we'd like to do in Massachusetts. We'd like to get something similar going in Massachusetts, and it's a political thing, and." We want here's what the church could do, and the meeting ended. The apostle left, and it was an apostle. And Mitt turned to the people that had from the stake leadership that had joined him in the meeting and said, "We're just not going to do that." And it's going back to what the Howard W. Hunter instruction earlier in the game. It's sort of illustrative of the approach that he took. He was making judgments about what the church was going to do in Massachusetts that was good for the church in Massachusetts. And he wasn't willing to apparently fall on a sword in that situation.
Ronald B. Scott is with us. His book is called Mitt Romney, An Inside Look at the Man and His Politics. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Ronald B. Scott. We're talking about his new book, Mitt Romney, An Inside Look at the Man and His Politics. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Janice, who's with us in Salt Lake City. Janice, welcome.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm sure the question I ask is something we've all heard about a thousand times, but I thought maybe he could shed some light on it. When Romney was running against Kennedy and claimed he'd be a better friend to gays than Kennedy, and was also pro-choice, I was shocked and amazed that a Republican Mormon would take such a stance. And now, obviously, he's recanted that and he's gone another way. Is there any reason that the gentleman can explain that?
Ronald Scott, let me back up just a minute, because one thing you write about in the book, and I wanted to get at this, is the run against Ted Kennedy, and what's significant about it in many ways, the reason he's having difficult a difficulty with the conservative wing of his party is that he had to find, as you put it in the book, some pragmatic solutions to the difficult social issues, in particular a woman's right to choose, but also gay rights as well. You talk about how there was, you know, they had put together some polling data that Romney, as he was sort of contemplating this run against Kennedy, and they figured that no candidate who opposed a woman's right to make, you know, her own decisions about abortion would win. And so he has to take this decision. What's interesting about it is that he sort of presents to his church leaders the fact that he's going to take a stance, which maybe isn't exactly pro-choice, but certainly represents something that that was, some would see anyway, is contrary to the positions of the church. And now he's a stake president at this time, if I get this right. And he has these meetings at the church administration building in Salt Lake City about presenting this idea. Tell that story, if you would.
Sure. And then I'll get to the caller's question as
right.
well. He was a sitting stake president, and he got polling data, the data that said nobody's going to be elected to a statewide office in Massachusetts who was anti-choice or seeks the repeal of Roe v. Wade. And armed with that data, he went to Salt Lake. He reached a position as to how did he feel the issue ought to be tackled, and he came down on the side of that. And it's a very Mormon kind of solution, if you ask me. The issue of free agency, just because you have the free agency to do something doesn't mean that you do it. But it means that you allow all people the right to make that decision for themselves. And so when he went to Salt Lake to say, well, I'm a stake president, I'm about to become a politician, run for a very prominent office that all the national media are going to be paying attention to, here's the position I'm going to take. He didn't go there for approval. He went to say, I don't want to surprise you. Here's the position I'm going to take, and the position is that I personally am opposed to abortion on demand, elective abortions, but I recognize the importance of allowing women to make that choice for themselves, and that's going to be my position. And he didn't go there looking for approval. He just went there looking to inform them. And as he left those meetings, and I got the impression it was more than one meeting, he said that he surprised people. People acknowledged that that was consistent with Mormon doctrine and teaching. But there were some that didn't agree with that, and that he burned some bridges, as to use his words, or at least left some of them smoking, a term he used as well.
Now, which takes us to the question then of gay rights. How does that factor in? Did he? Because you talk about the fact that this particular issue established a kind of pattern that you say he would follow in the years to come when thinking about his political ambitions, that not asking for permission, but certainly consulting with them or letting his church leaders know the way he was feeling. And then to Janice's question about how then he approached this question of gay rights. I mean, saying as he did, as Janice mentioned, that he would be a better friend to gay people than Ted Kennedy was. How does that fit into the story?
Well, number one, I don't have any evidence that he talked about the gay rights issues in 1993 with the leadership of the Mormon Church.
Okay.
And if he had, you could argue that he was acting as a change agent in saying to church leaders, you know, here's an interesting way you could approach this issue that would be consistent with what church teachings are, but still would allow people the right to be protected equally under law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But as I say, I don't have any evidence that he talked about that with church leaders at that time. Second part of your question, absolutely right that whenever he sought political office from that point on, and in the meantime, Gordon B. Hinckley became president of the Mormon Church. He was in a influential position in 1993, as you know, and they had a good personal relationship, and that was built up because of the Olympics and from 1998 to 2002. And so he began to use President Hinckley as a sounding board for his ideas. But it would be a mistake, I think, and I've done some pretty thorough reporting on this to conclude that he was looking for permission or for he may have been looking for a papal blessing. He didn't get it, but it was a natural kind of thing where he was turning to a man that he trusted for advice. And the truth of the matter is, I happen to know Gordon B. Hinckley personally, or I did. And he is one of a few people that I would turn to if I had the opportunity. I would turn to for advice on important life decisions. I wouldn't be looking for divine intervention or an answer from God. I'd be looking simply because I respect his judgment as a human being. And I think that's what Mitt was doing. And at one point, it reached the point where President Hinckley said, essentially, and this is a paraphrase, get out of here, go make your decision about whether you want to run for president or not, and I'll figure out how that will impact the church. I forgot the name of the caller, and I apologize
Janice,
for that.
Janice.
To Janice's call on gay rights, I see no evidence that he's changed his position on gay rights. What he's done, he's let his opposition to same-sex marriage sort of run interference for what he really feels about gay rights. And I think that his beliefs about that same-sex civil unions and equality under law regards taxation, hospital visitation, and all those other related entitlements remains consistent to where he was in 1993. And the position he was in 1993 was very advanced and progressive for its time. So the only difference there is the issue of same-sex marriage. But the record should show that he is the only governor in the U.S. That's actually implemented same-sex marriage in his state. Even though he opposed it, he opposed the ruling of the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts. When the push came to shove, he implemented the law. He didn't try to obstruct it like Governor Wallace did civil rights laws in Alabama. He said, this is the law, I'm going to enforce it, and he did. And I expect that if the Supreme Court rules in favor of same-sex marriage, probably during this presidential election term, that if he's elected president, he would enforce that law and support it, and that would be the end of it.
Janice Klechikol, thanks very much. One of the stories that has emerged in Romney's I guess it emerged probably when he was running for Senate. I'm not entirely sure, but there's the story of a woman named Carol Hilton Sheldon. I guess it's your reporting has revealed her name.
That's correct.
The mother of five. She was in her late 30s, had become pregnant and developed a blood clot. Her doctor told her that to continue the pregnancy could imperil her health. Her own state president comes to her and says, look, you need to follow your doctor's orders and you should consider this abortion. But then you say Romney comes to the hospital to essentially talk her out of it. And Sheldon says, you say in the book, that Romney had many good qualities, but that he didn't see her as a human being. What do you mean?
Is that a question?
Well, it's getting you to respond. Do you want me to put a question mark there?
No, it's okay. The question mark, I got it. She told part of her story anonymously in a Women's Exponent, which is a publication that was aimed at Mormon women, fairly liberal Mormon women. And what we did in the book is we put a name to it, and we also put quite a bit more detail. And the detail was when she got pregnant with the fifth child, right off the bat before she got sick, she was wondering whether she should have the child. And so it was fairly common knowledge in her ward, as I understand it, that she was considering, even before she got sick, that she would have an abortion. And she might consider having an abortion. She got sick, and the treatment that for her illness created a blood clot that lodged in her pelvis, and the treatment for that created a situation that could have damaged her kidneys, and her parents had flown in from the West to be there not only to take care of her child, but to be there in case she needed a kidney transplant. The stake president, Gordon Williams, advises her to follow her doctor's advice and to focus her attentions on her four existing children. He goes off on apparently a camping trip And Mitt, who is a very, very young bishop, and I think that's the key thing. He's a very young bishop. He enters into the picture. Now, probably he got to the hospital having been backgrounded by members of his ward that from the very beginning, she was talking about an abortion. Is this illness contrived, or is it really that life-threatening? So with that context, possibly, he enters the hospital room and advises her not to have the abortion and tells her he's concerned about the well-being of the child, and that's what he's there for. And then when she balks and said, well, President Williams advised me just to go ahead and follow the doctor's orders, he reacts and says, well, the state president wouldn't have said that, which is a reasonable reaction for a bishop to say of a state president. And he leaves and goes to the woman's house where her parents are and tries to enlist the father, the woman's father, in the effort to convince her to carry the baby to term. And that's where he got fairly imperious and all that, and that's where the story ends. Well, that tells me two things. Now, it tells me first and foremost, there was no church discipline taken against Carol Shelton, and so that tells me that the state president had advised her to go ahead and have the abortion, that her health was seriously impaired. And number two, it illustrates the fact that this was in a situation possibly where Mitt and the state president weren't on the same page, hadn't gotten in contact with each other, and he had to make some decisions based on limited information that he would have reacted differently had it been a different circumstance. And it also illustrates the fact that when you're a young bishop in charge of a lot of people who are older than you and savvier than you in some respects, you can get overly aggressive, and you can in your desire to do a good job, you can become unfeeling and demanding, and in your effort to guide people to make right decisions, you can become imperious even.
Ronald Scott, let me just contrast that, because you also write about another way Mitt Romney handled people, which I think is important to point out. Stories that have come out about Romney as a leader in the Salt Lake Tribune, you write about this as well. Peggy Fletcher Stack has written this article that talks about that abortion story, but also mentions how Romney stuck by one of his counselors who had been divorced and had been let go by the church education system. Romney didn't remove him from his position. You write about that as well. This other story of how when LDS Social Services wouldn't place a baby with a couple because the mother said she wanted to return to work, that Romney went to bat for this couple. You say that not one member of Romney's stake can remember him excommunicating or disfellowshipping a member. I guess that's the other part to this, that he wasn't just always imperious or wasn't always just following a rule book. He seemed like he was pretty nuanced in the way he approached his leadership as a stake president and as a bishop in some ways.
Right, and I think as a young bishop, that if he was imperious in this situation, it may have been driven by his desire to do the right thing. And one would have to conclude that based on the way he ran his own life and the way he counseled others. As a stake president, the Boston stake is known in the church is the better way stake, that everybody in the stake believes they know better than people in Salt Lake, and they press the limits all the time. Mm. So to go through 7-8 years of being a stake president and not have to take church discipline against anybody in the stake is quite remarkable. I would imagine it doesn't happen in any stake, let alone one as ornate as the Boston stake was at the time. So that, to me, says a lot about his ability to work with people and to work through very, very difficult situations, ones of probable personal morality as well as ones that have to do with shaky personal testimonies about gospel teachings and so on. So it shows really a very, very empathetic, agreeable, let's work this out kind of approach to life.
Ronald B. Scott is with us. His book is called Mitt Romney, An Inside Look at the Man and His Politics. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Ronald B. Scott. We're talking about his new book, Mitt Romney, An Inside Look at the Man and His Politics. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Janet in Spanish Fork writes this. She writes, what Utah Mormons, she puts that in quotations, what Utah Mormons don't understand is there's not the same culture, thank heavens, she writes, in the rest of the church that exists in Utah. Every area, city, state, or country has its own church culture, she says. Mitt Romney will obviously be different than someone else raised in Utah, and she says that's a very good thing. A question from Herb comes, Ronald Scott, which I wanted to put to you. Why is it? The question is always, why isn't Mitt Romney resonating with some voters? And the question is it because of his faith? What part of that plays into this? Is it just that he doesn't seem to connect in some ways emotionally, or you know, what part of that equation is the Mormon part? Can you tell at this point after having gone through this?
Well, I think it has absolutely nothing to do with his faith. No doubt there are people who will not vote for him simply because he is a Mormon. And you can't do anything about that. It's just something you've got to live with. But the biggest problem he has, in my estimation, is a personal one. He just hasn't been able to let his hair down to the point that he becomes credible with the people around him. And secondly, he hasn't exposed enough of his family life and his personal life to give people a sense of who is this guy? Is he for real? Is he too perfect? Is he like us or is he not like us? Can he relate to our personal issues? You know, a Mormon who works for Bain and a very smart guy drew the analogy that in times of crisis, people look for support from people who are really competent. In good times, people look for people who are competent to lead them so they can move to the next level and so forth. In times of crisis, his point was that you look for somebody who puts their arms around you and that reassures you, I've got your back. Wherever the crisis leads, what they're looking for in a leader in times of crisis is a Rudy Giuliani. And there's a chapter in the book that talks about Mitt's need to become Rudy Giuliani.
Right.
And I think he was given some advice in the beginning that you can win this by being competent and focusing on the competency issue over and over again and putting Mormonism, don't go there. Don't expose your family. Don't expose the positives of your religion. And those two things are the things that define Mitt. And that's what the people want to know more about. They want to understand what is there about Mormonism that recommends that you would be a good president, would make you a good president. What is it about your family that would reassure us that you're the right guy for this job? And here he's got, you know, five really attractive sons and daughters-in-law and grandkids who are all very well accomplished, an amazing accomplishment in this day and time. And we don't really know much about them. And yeah, there's some screwy people in the campaign, but if you think back to the campaign of Jimmy Carter and Billy Carter and his sisters. You know, Billy Carter made the comment one time that I've got a sister who is a born-again preacher, one who rides a motorcycle, a brother who wants to be president. Compared to them, I'm the sane guy in the family. That kind of good-natured bantering is there in the Romney family.
But he just doesn't show it.
It's not shown.
Yeah.
It's not shown, unfortunately. And I think that's what people are hungering for is who is let's see the real Romney stand up here.
Let's say Romney didn't have political aspirations. Do you think he would have made it into the upper echelons of Mormon leadership? I mean, there's some sense that he was being groomed for this kind of leadership. Do you think Romney would have welcomed that kind of position, you know, where you essentially forego all of your worldly aspirations in favor of the church?
Yeah, I actually do.
Really?
But I think a lot of Mormons would forego a lot if they're called to serve. That is one of the redeeming things about Mormonism that makes it really attractive as an organization is that people will feel they own part of the rock, a piece of the rock, and if you can convey that kind of commitment to Americans that they own a piece of the rock, that they have accountability for the way America turns out. If you can sell that, it will make America a better place. He's not going there because it's too religious and so on and so forth. But to answer your question directly, I think that if he'd been called to serve as a general leader of the church, that he would have accepted it. That's just where he comes from. That's part of his DNA.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't become president this time around, I suppose that could still happen. I don't know that it would because he's so embedded in the political side that might may be a liability for the church to have somebody so prominent in politics.
I want to ask
church
you,
leadership.
Forgive me for stepping in here. Let me, because we've got less than a minute, but I did want to ask you one more question. You know, coming to the question of who is the real Mitt Romney, you ask some compelling questions. For example, one of them is there a positive associated with Romney's obsession to always wanting to be on the right side? You say that could serve as he could serve as a bridge builder rather than a polarizing figure. That might be one of the positives there. Ronald Scott, about 30 seconds left, but say something finally about that, if you would.
Well, I'm thinking about LBJ and the Civil Rights Amendment of 1964. He was anti-civil rights up until that point, but he was the guy that put the deal together. So in terms of change, is the guy who's going to facilitate change the guy who's in favor of it, or is it somebody who can work out a compromise between all the factions and move people forward? And being willing to represent the people, whatever the people want, is a very good thing. So being able to change your mind because in the effort to represent the people is a positive thing if it's presented in the proper way.
It's Ronald B. Scott. His book is called Mitt Romney, An Inside Look at the Man and His Politics. Joined us from a studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. Ronald Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.